These last few weeks, the Dharma talks have been on really what are the components of our practice and how do we deepen our practice. And I'd like to spend the time this evening on one aspect of deepening practice, a place of paying attention that is very, very challenging and incredibly rewarding when we are willing. And that is working with the kind of anger and judgments that most of us spend a lot of time in. And actually framing that, the arena of anger where we get tripped off or judgment as a place of intentional practice. That we actually leave and say, okay, in that area I'm going to really explore the freedom that's possible. And I want to start by sharing with you a story, a friend of mine that called a few weeks ago to talk. This is a Buddhist practitioner, and he works in a very, very large corporation. He's a CFO. He's got a lot of influence. And he's in a kind of a dance, kind of a locked-in dance with a colleague who also has a lot of influence and who is trying to, in some way, undermine him. So he withholds information. He doesn't get CC'd on critical emails. And there's a lot of ways that this colleague seems to slant presentations to make him look bad. So there's a real difficult thing going on. And he is in a chronic state of anger and mistrust, and his mind's always anticipating how this guy is going to pull the next trick. And he feels like he's living in this very small-minded place. And he basically called me and he said, well, you know, if the Dharma works, then there's got to be some way that I can, in my 9-to-5, actually it's a 7-to-9 job, but in my workaday world, there's got to be some way that there can be living with more honesty and more trust at work. And his basic question was, I want to be awake, I want to be open-hearted, and I don't want to get screwed. What do I do? That was really basically what he was saying to me. So we talked, and it was clear that this colleague has caused him trouble, has injured his reputation, and would try to continue probably. I mean, that was a likelihood. And so the first step was to say, okay, so that's wise discrimination, to look at what's what and sense what's happened before and just acknowledge, okay, so hurtfulness can happen, and it has and it might again. But we talked about the difference between recognizing that and carrying around that ball of anger, carrying around that kind of mind that keeps on spinning and judging and blaming, and that kind of clench where he's believing the story of bad person, that's a bad person. He's believing the story of, you know, you're nasty, you're mean, you're wrong. So he spent a few weeks exploring what happened when those stories were spinning in his mind. Not the wise discrimination of, yes, this could undermine me at work, but the kind of ongoing stories about how wrong that person was and bad and the anger and the dislike. He started to use that as his flag, his mindfulness flag. Okay, every time that comes up, I'm going to pay attention to what is going on in my body and in my heart. And what he found was his heart was clenched. There was like, it was almost like there was this steel kind of band around it squeezing. His heart was, and when he told me what his mind was like, it was like his world had shrunk and it was dark and small. And when I said, what's your sense of self like? He said, actually, I feel as ugly as he is by living in that. And so as he kind of deepened his attention, he could feel he was anxious, he was afraid. And when he could really just stay with that anxiety and fear, he began to find some space around it. Like, okay, that's natural that would be what I would feel. And he could begin to look at this guy and sense he's scared too. He's just fighting to make his way work. And so then he just experimented from having a little more space. He just experimented in his, with his behaviors a little, like pulling out cough drops when the guy coughed and kind of a few self-depreciating remarks that were just, you know, just to lighten things up, and included him in a business luncheon when he didn't need to. And the guy started having a little bit less of an edge. Now, I don't want to leave it like everything's happily ever after and the guys have, you know, gone off into la-la land, but there's a shift. And mostly, he said, the shift was in him. As he said, my experience of who I am is larger. There's just more of a sense of, okay, I'm more at home in myself, is what he said. I wanted to share that because there's some little, it's a little bit like Aikido, you know, that if one person, when it's locked in anger, when there's war, if anybody begins to, instead of keep on fueling the you're bad, you're wrong, I'm right, if anybody steps out of that drama and begins to just let themselves feel the vulnerability in the moment, there's some movement towards understanding. It's just a movement. But it's towards healing. John Paul II writes, "Do not be afraid to take the chance on peace, to teach peace, to live peace. Peace will be the last word of history." And I would add, if we're fortunate, you know, if we wake up, peace does not mean we don't protect ourselves. But I love the language, take the chance on peace, because there is a quality of courage. There's a quality of courage that absolutely is essential if we're going to be willing to step out of the trance of our anger, that kind of being right feeling, and actually feel what's going on underneath. It takes courage. And we're taking a chance because the other person might not meet us in any way that makes us feel good. We might feel in some way shamed, or we might feel pushed away. We might feel that our effort was futile. Doesn't matter. Take the chance on peace means something in us is more committed to waking up from the trance than we are to being right. If we're honest and we look at our daily life, for most of us, it's filled with judgment. We're always, every step, we're just clicking off judgments. You know, better, worser, more powerful, less powerful, looks nicer, looks worser. You know, it's just like ongoing, and a lot of them have an aversive tinge where we are just in some way assuming something's wrong and we're at war. And we're addicted to this thinking and judging. We're addicted to it, to blaming ourselves for stuff and blaming others. And it's part of our survival equipment, by the way. We are literally designed to anticipate or feel threats, to locate the source of the problem and take care of it. That means to blame. We're designed that way. But because we live with chronic stress, that the button associated with blame is on overtime. You know, we're feeling stressed and we're always assigning blame. It's me or it's someone else. And it happens in politics. We're in a constant sense of who's wrong. And we do it in our families and with our friends. Somebody sent me this today. And these are letters that Dear Abby admitted she was at a loss to answer. I'll just read one of them. "Dear Abby, I have a man I can't trust. He cheats so much, I'm not even sure the baby I'm carrying is his." So in some way, we, you know, blame. Now, I've turned this into a practice myself of, you know, like, we can't, like, be awake to everything that's going on in our lives, most of us, but we can pick certain areas that we know, if we're willing to deepen our attention, we're going to find out what we've been running from. Judgment is a big one. If all you did for the next year was say, okay, I'm going to start investigating what's under judging mind, it's as good a path to profound awakening and freedom as anything I've ever explored. So I watch for myself, and it doesn't matter whether it's light judgment or intense judgment, whether it's someone I know or someone I don't know. When I begin to scan my own body and mind, my heart is harder. I'm usually speedier, I'm tighter, and I am not liking myself. That's the most basic. When I'm in judgment, I don't like the who's here. That's just the experience. The only way to wake up from a negative sense of who's here is to pause and connect with what's going on in our bodies and our hearts at those times. So as we do often, I'd like to invite you to reflect for a moment, just to kind of put down things if you're holding things and come back really within. Just pay attention to your own experience. And take a few full breaths so that you can really feel yourself in your body, right here, aware of what's happening. And just to bring this alive for yourself tonight, you might reflect on a situation where you're in some way at odds with another person. And it might be in a, you know, not so intense way, but there's still some distance, or it might be where it's more intense, where you're experiencing real anger. But some situation where there's a sense of blaming going on. And let the situation be right here and real, so you can really get what's triggering it. What's so bad? What did the other do wrong? What really is bothering you about this? For some, it might be hard to find something. It might be a way you're really blaming yourself. Or you're down on yourself for some way you've been doing things or treating others or not coming through. Either way, whether it's blaming another or blaming yourself, sense what's really bothering you, where the wrongness is, how the other is doing wrong, you're doing wrong. And sense, what does it feel like to blame, to be in blaming self, where your sense of your being is organized around blaming? Just feel, what's it like in your body? You might exaggerate the blaming, as if you were telling the person or telling yourself what's so wrong. Just hear yourself saying the words in an angry voice. If you had cared about me, you wouldn't have, or whatever it is. What's your body feel like? What's your mind feel like? What's your sense of your own being when you're in, when you have a grievance, when you're angry? Do you feel more powerful? Do you feel really contracted? Do you feel small or tight? Do you like the sense of who you are? Do you feel at home? Another question. If you couldn't keep on being angry and blaming, if you had to for some reason let go of it, what underlying feeling would you have to directly experience? What would be there if you couldn't feel angry? What would you be stuck having to feel that maybe you don't want to feel? What is the anger or blame covering over? You keep on investigating that, but you might, when you're ready, open your eyes. And maybe we can just, as a group, just put a few words out there, because I think it's really helpful to look at this. What do you notice? If you weren't angry, what would you be stuck having to feel? Anybody? Let's hear some. I'm sorry? Less than. If I wasn't able to hold on to my anger, I'd be stuck feeling less than, in some way inferior. Yeah. Sadness. If anger wasn't there, I'd be sink into some really big sadness. Yeah. Others? Fear. Yeah. If I can't hold on to that angry self, I get stuck in the real vulnerability of fear. Thank you. Yeah. Emptiness. So the anger kind of consolidates us, and underneath that's kind of some hole or emptiness. Yeah, these are there's no wrong answer, by the way, so don't be shy. What else? I'm sorry? Shame. Yeah, put aside the anger, and then there's this kind of undercurrent of shame. Up in the balcony? Depression? Compassion. So once the anger is not there, if we really stay present, then we can open up to compassion. And that's why we're opening, and there's usually some layers in between before we get there. So, yeah, back. Pity. So there might be a quality of pity underneath that. And if you couldn't feel the pity, then what would you have to feel? You can just kind of reflect on that, because this is an unlayering. Any else? Anybody else? I'm sorry? Subordinate. So there's a lower, it's almost like the anger puffs us up and gives us a kind of temporary false kind of power. Did some of you feel that? And all of a sudden there's a deflation, subordinate, less than, maybe powerless, empty. Frustrated? Is that what somebody said? Yeah, so the layers under to frustration. The reason I asked you to reflect on this is that anger is a well-honed strategy to help us, first of all, it's intelligent, to help us detect when there's a threat and act on it. And it's also protective so that we don't have to sit down in our vulnerability. There's a deep vulnerability. It's either a feeling of hurt, fear, or that whole range of what you describe. We'd rather be angry than sit down in that vulnerability. So the challenge is, when anger arises, it doesn't help to push it away, and it doesn't help to get caught in the storyline. In other words, there's a habit, especially if we have this kind of spiritual notion that being angry is not, you know, a high-minded thing, that we should get rid of it. So there's a, sometimes we kind of like, that's not who I am, or we try to push it under or make things okay. We feel sometimes weak or defective for our anger. Like it's a sign of our badness. For myself, when anger arises, very often I will just put a soft note saying, forgiven, forgiven. And what I mean by that is not, oh, I have sinned and I'm forgiving myself, but more that, okay, so this energy's here and it's really okay. It's just part of, it's like an inner weather system. It's really okay to be angry. So that's the first part, not pushing it away, forgiven, forgiven. But also, there's this intention not to get caught in the storyline of right and wrong. That's where the suffering happens. So to not get caught in believing in rightness. Joko Beck put it this way. She said, our failure to know joy is a direct reflection of our inability to forgive. Let me say that again. Our failure to know joy is a direct reflection of our inability to forgive. Now, in a way, I could stop right there, because that really is what it's about. When we buy into the storyline of you're wrong, I'm wrong, and we let that separateness be there, we can't know joy. Not just can't know joy, we can't realize the inner freedom of who we are because we get caught in a sense of a small angry self. It obscures the truth of who we are. So I love the way Pope John Paul II said, take the chance on peace, because the beginning of getting out of that trance of I'm right, you're wrong, or I'm wrong, is to begin to just be committed to recognizing when it arises. Recognition is the first step. We have to see our pattern. Every one of us here, every one of us, because we all have vulnerability, have ways of running away from it. And judgment, grievance, blame is such a big one. So how do we do it? For my corporate friend, it was very obvious his way of doing it. He was just spinning ongoing stories about this guy's wrongness and badness. And his body was incredibly tight. And often we rally others to support us in our rightness, and he was doing the same thing. And sometimes it expands, and when we're in that state of irritation, we start thinking a lot of people are doing it wrong. Our blame gets very widespread. We're seeing everybody as off in some way, at fault. One man was driving home from work. It had been a rough day. His wife calls him on a cell phone. She's distraught. She's heard on the radio that someone is driving on the Beltway the wrong way. Heck, Emma, he replies, there's hundreds of them doing that, you know? That kind of distortion. So that's one of our patterns. Last month I had this patch where it was just an incredible lineup. One, I had a friend that didn't respond to a call. My son hadn't arranged his summer courses the way he was supposed to. My accountant was late with certain things with the taxes. It's like I had this free-floating irritation, and anything that went on, it was like not sensitive to my needs, not doing things right, doing it the wrong way. It's like everybody was driving the wrong way during that patch. It just locks in. And then when I look closer, each one of those, I could find, when I slowed down, a kind of vulnerability in myself of I was feeling bad or wrong. So we blame outward, we generalize it, we get armored in our body. Just begin to notice when you're judging in a much more kind of close and intimate way. What's your body doing? John Wellwood talks about how, in a way, when we are at war with someone in our lives, it's not any different than being a terrorist in certain ways. And this is how he puts it. He says, nursing a grievance, treating our intimate partner as someone to get back at, or resenting how badly life or other people have treated us, is a self-destructive act. For in wanting to hurt or reject someone or something we resent, we unwittingly wind up hurting or rejecting ourselves at the same time. This is easy to see. Just notice how your whole body tightens and constricts when you hold something against someone. When you do this, you're destroying your own life, the presence, openness, and warmth that is your lifeblood. So to make the other bad at the expense of feeling good ourselves is really to choose death over life, just like a suicide bomber. It's a matter of degree. But when we're at war, we're really tightening our heart and cutting off our aliveness. So we have different strategies, each of us. Some of us, when we're at war, go into real fight mode, and we want to punish others for what they're doing wrong. And we want to get rid of the people in our lives that are making us feel bad in some way by attacking them, judging them, making distances with them. Rita Rudner puts it this way. She says, my grandmother was a very tough woman. She buried three husbands. Two of them were just napping. So that's the fighting approach. Then there's some people that our anger and blame is actually in a more withdrawing way, that it's passive aggressive. We get angry and our way of acting it out is to pull back from people, to withdraw from people, to not respond to questions, to ignore, to close off that way. And then for many, there's a vacillation. The extreme example is like an abusive spouse who is very, very violent and abusive and then feels incredibly ashamed and then gets very apologetic, between the legs, and acts really, tries to be good and then just lashes out again, goes back and forth. But many of us do that. We get, in some way, we act in a mean-spirited way and then we try to make up for it. And it's because we're afraid of being punished for what we do. One of my examples of this, David received a parrot for his birthday. This parrot was the angriest parrot you've ever seen. Bad attitude, worse vocabulary. Every other word was an expletive. And those that weren't expletives were, to say the least, rude. Very angry parrot. David tried hard to change the bird's attitude, was constantly saying polite words, playing soft music, anything that came to mind. Nothing worked. He yelled at the bird got worse. He shook the bird, and the bird got madder and ruder. Finally, in a moment of desperation, David put the parrot in the freezer. For a few moments, he heard the bird squawking, kicking, and screaming, and then suddenly all was quiet. David was frightened that he might have actually hurt the bird and quickly opened the freezer door. The parrot calmly stepped out onto David's extended arm and said, "I'm so sorry I offended you with my language and actions. I ask your forgiveness. I will try to check my behavior." David was astonished at the bird's change in attitude and was about to ask what changed him when the parrot continued, "May I ask what the chicken did?" To the vegetarians in the room, forgiveness. So here's an important piece. The greater our reactivity, in other words, the more locked we're into being wronged, the stronger the unexamined vulnerability. Let me give you another example that what I found really touching. A woman who's a very dear friend, a therapist on the West Coast, African-American woman who's worked with a lot of gang members, the women in the gangs, and worked with a woman over several years. And she called me because she was really in this looping of blaming and anger because her client had made a very thinly veiled criticism that basically said, you know, "You're letting me down, you're not doing a good job, you don't really understand me." She was basically saying, "I don't trust you." And for this woman, as for many of us, to feel mistrusted is incredibly painful. So she called me because she was so angry at her client, and she was just, you know, how could she have these inappropriate expectations? She's manipulating me. She, you know, just really, really angry. And she knew she was angry, and she was mostly feeling terrible about how caught she was in it. So I asked her the question, which is, if you couldn't be blaming her right now, what would you have to feel or experience? Try it out. You know, if I couldn't be judging and blaming, making someone wrong, what would I have to feel? And for her, it was that I'm bad. It was just basically, I'm unworthy of trust. I'm a failure. So she was like this basic badness. And so I said, okay, so this anger is covering over that sense of basic badness. Can you just forgive that it's there? Because it's really painful to drop into that. So she forgiven. And then that made her a little less hardened. And then I invited her to open to the feeling of badness. And I said, what will help you to open to that? Because she said it's really hard to let go into that. It's like she thought that she just almost like she would die if she had to really feel the full-blown enormity of personal badness. And so she said, well, it helps that you're here with me, because I know you care. And so she just brought to mind the people in her life that she knew loved her and knew her goodness. It was like we were like a circle around her. And then she began to just open into what was in her body and breathe with it. And feeling that circle of people that cared about her helped her to just touch the feeling of badness. It was like sensations in her body. It was a sinking, dark, heavy, thick feeling in her throat and her chest that was like pulling her down, like into a deep, endless swamp. And she just kept breathing with it and breathing with it. And she found that when she could really, without adding anything on, just say, okay, this feels like suffering, she started sensing a kindness towards it. And I had her do what I often do, which is just place her hand on her own heart to breathe with the badness, the feeling of badness, and just offer it a profound presence. I think of this as a kind of fearless presence. It's the essence of mindfulness, where we're with what we've been running from for sometimes decades, and we just stay. This is the turning point when we're caught in the trance of anger, that instead of staying in the story, we come into our body and we stay with what we've been running from, the vulnerability. We breathe with it. We open to it. For her, it just opened up the space and the kindness that she could see with her client, that she had just hit a wall of fear that she was going to be abandoned, that nobody was going to be there for her. So she was being tested, you know, and that happens. And it gave her the space and the compassion to show up at another level, and they dropped even deeper in their trust. It doesn't always work that way. Anger has an intelligence, and sometimes, as my business friend knows, it might not become nice and easy, but all you can do is wake up and develop more forgiveness in your heart. Sometimes we don't have time to reflect. We don't have time to put aside a storyline. We don't have time to get in touch with our body. And I want to just note that sometimes things happen and our biological anger will, you know, somebody pulls out a gun or a knife or something, and biologically our anger will be a very helpful friend in having us defend or protect or move away. But that's usually not the case for us. Usually what's going on is more the kind of offense of demeaning words or of neglectful, emotionally harming behaviors. And our practice, should we want to feel some freedom, should we want to really rediscover a bigness of heart, is again and again to put aside the storyline and to come home into our body, to forgive that the anger's there, to feel what's happening with our breath. Maybe what we'll feel is a sense of badness, as this woman, this therapist on the West Coast. Or maybe we'll feel like this incredible fear and powerlessness that's often there, or an incredible amount of hurt. But the medicine is be with it, and in that being with, we end up finding some space and heart. We take a chance on peace. I want to just invite you to check in again, as we did before. We'll just practice a little bit. So as we often do, this is a kind of pause to let you really see, well, what does this mean in my life? The Buddha just always had this wonderful phrase, ehi pasiko, which is come and see for yourself, you know. What happens when you begin to bring presence to what's underneath the blame? So you might again just bring to mind any situation where you feel kind of caught in that reactive place. Just take your time, take a few moments to either return to the one you had before, if you didn't have one, sense if there's any situation with someone that you'd like to maybe find a little more understanding and connection. Put aside the resentment. Take a chance on peace. But it starts with recognizing where is there a reaction. Just a sense how you're holding the blame. What's really so disturbing? You know, how have you been done wrong? And just to, with honesty, acknowledge, okay, resentment. Yeah, I'm carrying a grievance. And forgive that. We're biologically wired to do that. But that's not the end of the story. You might ask yourself, okay, if I wasn't going to be running the story of right and wrong, if I wasn't going to hold on to the anger or the resentment, what would be here? What's underneath? And you might feel underneath a bit of that vulnerability. As Krishnamurti said, there's no learning, there's no awakening unless we touch the vulnerability. You might sense that there's some powerlessness or shame, hurt, fear. Whatever you notice, maybe just confusion or numbness, just to breathe with what's here. Just let it be here. You can't do this wrong. Just notice how your experience is and breathe with that. If it helps to put your hand on your heart and accompany, give presence with a kind of tender touch. So you're offering the vulnerability, that gesture of care. Okay, so there's hurt or fear, powerlessness, maybe numbness, maybe feeling cut off. It's okay. Just to breathe with that. And if it helps you to feel that you're accompanied by others, by the energy of others that care about you and understand you, if it helps to bring to mind someone who believes in you and trusts you, so that energy is also communicated with the touch of your hand or just the feeling of being here. And just to honestly connect with whatever is true inside you. To take a chance on peace is to have the courage to feel what's underneath the blame. If we do it personally, we begin to discover a quality of space and kindness. You might sense, who would I be if I wasn't carrying anger and judgment? Who would I be without the judgment? Can you sense the openness, the awareness, the tenderness? And it's the same in our world. If we could let go of the right and wrong and really open to the vulnerability of our hearts, that's taking a chance on peace. A few years ago, a young boy, when he was 14, I think, died. His name was Matty Stepanek, and some of you might remember from this area. He is a poet, muscular dystrophy, and he wrote a poem I'd like to read you. He says, "We need to stop, just stop stop for a moment before anybody says or does anything that may hurt anyone else. We need to be silent, just silent. Silent for a moment before we forever lose the blessing of songs that grow in our hearts. We need to notice, just notice. Notice for a moment before the future slips away into ashes and dust of humility. Stop, be silent, and notice. In so many ways we are the same. And now let us pray differently yet together before there is no earth, no life, no chance for peace. So in these last few moments, you might bring to mind if there's another person you've been blaming, to see if you can let that person also be here in your awareness and heart and sense the truth of their vulnerability. The fear or hurt or confusion that would have them act or behave as they do. Sense the difference of who you are when you're blaming and who you are when you're seeking to sense vulnerability in another, when your intention is to forgive. So I'd like to just, kind of as a way of closing words, say that this domain, paying attention to blaming, is very humbling because it's the last thing we want to do often is put down our blaming and get in touch with stuff. It's just a very deep way of protecting ourselves. So in a way, it takes a lot of patience with ourselves, just to let this be something we begin to practice more, but to know there's incredible fruits to beginning to wake up out of this trance of blaming. Our bodies get a lot happier. They really do. It's good for our health. Our blood pressure goes down. Our immune system gets stronger. Stress hormones go down. It's really good for our body, but in a deeper way, as long as we're judging, we're blocked from being at home in ourselves. So this investigation, seeing behind the blaming and opening to the vulnerability and then to the space of heart and presence is really a pathway home. It really helps us to recognize again the awareness and the vast space of heart that's what we are and yet has been obscured. And it frees us to live from that. There's a description of the path, which is that we begin by realizing what's going on, and that realization gets more and more familiar, and we really mature as we embody a forgiving heart. We embody it. We like live it in our moments. And so that what happens is, rather than our behaviors being centralized around a self that's trying to get more for me and blame you, we are very free to respond to the needs of the people around us. I want to read you a short story of a Argentino golfer, Roberto De Vincesco. Once won a tournament, and after receiving a check and smiling for the cameras, he prepared to leave. He was still relatively new at this, and as he walked alone into the parking lot, he was approached by a young woman who congratulated him and then told him that her son was seriously ill and near death. She didn't know how she could pay the doctor's bills and hospital expenses. And he, who was known as a gentleman, was so touched by her story that he took a pen out and endorsed the day's winnings to her. He pressed it into her hand and said, "Make some good days for the baby." couple of weeks later, he was at another country club, and one of the officials came over and said, some of the boys in the parking lot at the last tournament told me what happened with that young woman you met. He nodded. Well, said the official, I have news for you. She's a phony. She's no sick baby. She's no children at all. She's fleeced you, my friend. You mean there's no baby who's dying, said Roberto. That's right, said the official. Why, that's the best news I've heard all week. There is a freedom that comes when we are not organized around making others wrong, and when we're not organized around making ourselves wrong. But it takes courage. It takes courage. So we'll just take these last few moments, if you will. Again, this practice of just come home, close your eyes, just be here for a few moments in a quiet way. In these moments, just to be at home with whatever the experience is. Maybe tired or restless, maybe happy, maybe open. Whatever it is, to just notice and allow. Notice and allow. Do not be afraid to take the chance on peace, to teach peace, to live peace. Peace will be the last word of history.
The teaching you have received has been freely offered. If you would like to contact the Insight Meditation Community of Washington to make a donation or to learn more about our programs, please visit our website at www.imcw.org.